Over the course of 30 years, Story Musgrave paved his way into NASA history as one of its most colorful, passionate, and dedicated astronauts. As a Renaissance man, adventurer, spaceman, and storyteller, he weaves a thought-provoking presentation, which he'll be doing on Saturday, the 12th of May at 7:30, in person at the Proctor's GE Theater in Schenectady, New York. Story Musgrave was a NASA astronaut for over 30 years, flew on 6 space flights. He performed the first shuttle spacewalk on Challenger's first flight, was a pilot on an astronomy mission, conducted 2 classified DoD missions, was the lead spacewalker on the Hubble telescope repair mission, and on his last flight, he operated an electronic chip manufacturing satellite on Columbia. It's a great pleasure to welcome Story Musgrave to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Wow.
A great pleasure.
That was a nice send-off.
Well, thank you very much. It is, you know, you're coming to Schenectady, and of course, we broadcast to the Stockbridge, Massachusetts area. I did not realize you were from Stockbridge.
Yeah, so we had a farm. We had a dairy farm there. We milked about 100 head. Guernseys.
And you were very much of the land. You enjoyed...
I was, yes, sir. You've done your homework. I'm very, very much of the land. It's hard not to be. And you know you live right there. The Berkshire's not that much different across the river. But it's like the Lake Poets, you know. When you're in the Berkshires, you're pretty much immersed in nature all the way around. And we were on the Housatonic River, too, so that helps to immerse you. But I think the big pine trees was the most powerful force to bring me into nature and to make me feel comfortable there, the pine forests.
Do you get a sense at that point, much, I would assume, like space, of just how big it all is?
Yeah, I suppose a very large pine forest for a young, very young child. I was in the woods at age 3. That's about as big as space gets. Space is not comprehensible. The single pictures Hubble takes of 300 trillion stars in the same picture. Now, that's big, but what's it mean? I mean, it's not comprehensible. What, 2,000 galaxies? It's not comprehensible. It's great. We're part of the process.
Do you try to comprehend it? I mean, even when you're there and afterwards, is it something that you consciously try to work out in your mind?
No. Not 300 trillion stars. No, I have no idea.
Yeah.
I don't try to. You raised the question. It is, in fact, an incomprehensible immensity. That's the way it is. There's probably no end either. So, you know, there is no end. And I also don't think there was a beginning. I don't believe in Big Bang. I believe it's a singularity of events, you know, singularity of physics. But I do believe there was a precursor. But it gets down to the question, can you comprehend it? I can think about things as always having been. I don't have to have a beginning or an end. So I think the universe always was and always will be.
You have graduate degrees in math and computers and chemistry and medicine and physiology and literature and psychology, not only being well-rounded, but of course also very much based in science. And yet you feel that there's that precursor, that unexplained. And for you, that never got in the way of the science?
No, well, it brings up a serious question, and that is... It's possible you cannot teach a dog quantum mechanics. Well, it's also possible that part of the truth of the universe are principles which our constitution does not permit us to comprehend. It's the same as a dog in quantum mechanics. Maybe it's too abstract, and it is beyond what their gifts to be able to perceive and to, you know, to think about those things. I also think this truth in the universe, the human cannot comprehend by definition. Their constitution does not allow them to. They would not like those ideas.
What was it like when you started flying with the Marines and 55 years accumulated 18,000 hours in over 160 aircraft? What was it about flying and taking it one step further each time.
Yeah, it's one step at a time. But you look upon each little step as a playing field. You got a new airplane. You and the airplane define a new playing field. And what are the rules of this game? What do I need to do? What do I need to know? What outcome am I trying to achieve? What is the goal? And how do you get there? So every me and every airplane, then, is a new playing field. And it's a metaphor that I teach. It's good for kids, too. It's one step at a time to build a portfolio, how to design a life. And so I'll touch upon that at the Proctor Theater, how you design a life one step at a time. And it's a nice way to think about it, because if kids look at me, they'll say, he's not relevant because he's not possible. It's just you can't do what he's done. But if you tell a little story one step at a time, it's very reasonable.
At what point did you know that not only were you going to be an astronaut, but that being a trauma surgeon would be a part of your duties, that would be something that you wanted to explore?
Now, I was heading for neurophysiology and neurosurgery because I got into medicine through computers and operations research. So I got into medicine by being interested in the brain and how it worked. But I didn't know whether I should go PhD or MD or research or, you know, which way to approach it. But rather than burn any bridges before I got there, I went MD. So that's what led me to there. But I had to get into medicine to look at the emergency room, to look at trauma. And that fit much better into my design of medical systems for the space program. You know, designing medical systems as I did for Shuttle and Skylab to meet contingency events. So trauma was more applicable to the remote medicine you practice in space. It was also logistically more applicable to my life in that when I go to practice something 2 or 3 days a month, I get what comes in the door. I don't get what comes in schedule, because if it comes in schedule, it's already scheduled for somebody else. So it was logistically a good way to go, but it also fit more with medicine in space.
So that medical aspect, was that always a part of your duties and always in the back of your mind when you're taking that first shuttle spacewalk on Challenger?
No, it was never really part of my duties. I had very little to do with except for the design of spacesuits. The design of spacesuits, I was able to use a lot of physiology, a lot of ergonomics and anthropometrics and human factors and that kind of stuff, which is related, of course, to medicine physiology. So that's really the only direct. I didn't have medical missions. I have some physiological experiments, some biological experiments on board some of my flights, but mostly I didn't function as a physician. I did designing the in-flight medical support system for Shuttle and for Skylab, but most of the time I was not a physician. I was a generalist, and I would pick up whatever specialty disciplines were on a given mission I was assigned to.
Once you were assigned to a mission, how much say do you have in what happens? How much input do you get in what is achieved?
Well, it's mostly the choreography. I think it's mostly how you're going to get the job done. I think the missions come together, and here's the mission objectives, and you work out the how, so you are instrumental in the how the job is going to get done. You may not be too instrumental in, well, I go fix Hubble. They told me what's broke. That defines a mission. You know, the first visit to Hubble, the repair mission, the mission is defined by what's broken and what's got to get fixed. So I have little part in that. But I'm principal in how we're going to get that job done. So most of my other missions, too, I did not define mission requirements or what payloads are beyond them. You're right there. So I'm instrumental in how we're going to get the job done.
In getting the job done, I mean, obviously in the case of Hubble, you have the experience of spacewalking. You have that. But of the actual repair, Do you know what is wrong, what you have to do, or do you have to do a bit of diagnostic work while you're there?
I know. Hopefully not. Hopefully you have a plan ahead of time. And we did. So if you have additional failures that happen when you're up there, that's something else. But no, hopefully in that kind of thing, you have a complete plan. That's when Dorothy Hamill, I used to train with her. Well, she takes the ice at the Olympics. You know, she's not going to research what she's going to do. You want to have a plan. You want to have an exceedingly detailed plan and follow the plan. And that's true of all people. All people that achieve a certain level of performance are working on a plan, everybody. So when you get on an airplane in Albany and you're going to Atlanta, the total thing is scripted beginning to end. Every damn thing starts with the design of the airplane and the manufacture of the airplane, design of the airport, the whole darn thing. Every single tiny little thing when you jump on an airplane in Albany, go somewhere. That's planned. And that you want it to be, because now your safety is in the standardization of doing things and the systematization of all the processes. So the processes have been proven over decades, and that's what you're relying upon.
Of course, you have that plan, but
obviously... You plan on surprises.
Yeah.
you not only train and get ready for what you need to do, but you have contingency plans, too. When things don't turn out the way you plan, there's certain probabilities, and you try to look at certain things which have definitive probabilities and be able to accommodate them also. So you have a bunch of backup plans also. But then when it gets right down to it, you do have a huge set of tools to get unplanned jobs done if they were to occur. But the real help, of course, is mission control. They are the real help. When you get into heavy surprises, they're the ones going to look after you. You know, you're on the spot. You're Johnny on the scene, so you can help. But mission control, they're the people going to look after you.
Story Musgrave will be speaking at Proctor's GE Theater on Saturday at 7:30. We will continue our conversation with Story Musgrave after the short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Story Musgrave is our guest. We are talking about his appearance at Proctor's GE Theater on Saturday, the 12th of May at 7:30. You can find out more information by going to proctors.org. You were such a part of the shuttle program, and now that it has ended, what do you think the legacy of it will be? The follow-up being, are you sorry to see it go? Was there more to do?
Well, there's always more to do. If you only look at the shuttle program, I think it ended in a very, very nice place. I think it did exactly what it set out to do in terms of expanding the way we operate in space. It did not turn out the way we planned technically, like 10 million per flight. It cost 1.2 billion a flight in the last analysis, and it was massively fragile, massively dangerous, a massively complex vehicle, and the complexity is what made it turn out not the way we planned. But if you look at 73, when we did our first space station called Skylab, and you look at where we are in 2012, the shuttle matured us as a space-faring nation. We are exceedingly good now. New sciences, new technologies, new way of doing business. You know, assembling, building stuff, fixing stuff. We are a massively mature space-faring nation now, and the shuttle program did that. So even though it didn't turn out as planned, I think it's got to be called a huge success. It wasn't exploration in terms of exploring new geography beyond Earth orbit, but it did its job. We're ready to go.
You mentioned the fact of it being exceedingly dangerous. Did you always know that? I mean, even before...
Oh, sure, I knew that. I knew that in the early 70s. So I knew of complexity in the early 70s. NASA did not. We that flew it did know. Man, we were shaking in our boots back in 71. course. Gee whiz, man. Yeah, we knew that back then. But we were what you call authentic. We had an authentic grasp of the technology we were coming up with.
And so you always know the dangers, but that can't get in the way of the mission and the work.
It can. But you make a decision. Are you still in the game? I mean, you make a decision. You accept the risk because you belong in space, which I do. I'm good up there. So I belong up there, but so do you accept that much risk? And, well, I kept doing it. I don't accept the amount of risk. I hate that amount of risk. So I'm not a risk taker.
What makes you good up there? What made you good?
Well, first of all, I understand zero gravity. I understand the evolutionary aspects of who I am and where I came from. That started with a kid, Mother Earth, so I was in contact with Earth. And I think about how I'm an evolutionary creature. I think about Earth that formed me, you know, and now I know very well, both intuitively and emotionally, and all I know what zero-G is. And so I know how to work there. But I also know how to choreograph. I know how to do the dance. I'm fluid. I'm adaptable, adjustable, accommodating, you know. I don't work there to conquer space, because that's not the way to think.
Mm.
The way is to surrender to space. Now you and it become one, see. If you go into some other culture, some of your environment, say, well, I'm gonna conquer this place. Well, you're not. So the true explorer then becomes one with the environment, not against it. You become one with it. You're not going to conquer space. So if your idea you're going to conquer something, that means I'm going to bring my current self and my current culture somewhere else and not change it. But then it's not all adaptable. It's not built for the new environment. So the idea of conquering things doesn't work.
In the relationship you have with your fellow astronauts through the training and through the actual mission, I can't imagine of how strong a bond there must be. Not that it's always lasting, but that
now, sometimes it's not a bond. We're the same as anyone else. We're the same as journalists or newspaper people. We have the same group dynamic. There are some groups that don't get along, and some groups do get along. Some groups are horribly incompatible, and some groups are very compatible. I flew on both kinds of crews. I flew on incompatible crews, and I flew on compatible crews. I had the widest of extremes in that regard, the compatibility. But professionally, it doesn't go as well. An incompatible crew does not do as well. But professionally, they get the job done despite the incompatibility. Unfortunately, NASA never selected for compatibility. That was not part of their selection criteria. Their selection criteria was more logistical.
Should it be? In the sense of, because you're talking about trust in many cases.
Well, you can trust someone you don't get along with. You can trust them for their competence and their professionalism. But if they're true professionals, you're going to get along with them because you respect their professionalism and you admire their professionalism. And so that's part of the thing that pulls you together. But NASA flies all the time, crews that are not compatible. They're not socially compatible. They just don't get along.
If they tested for...
So it's kind of a myth that says astronauts get along with each other. They don't. And of course you would expect they would not. Because you can take any group of people in any team. There's disharmonies and there's friction. I don't care who you are. So they have that. They have that, but they live with it.
And in no time through the process, through the extensive training, can you voice those concerns about a particular individual?
No, you can recognize the incompatibility. It's good to recognize it. It's good to see it, and you can deal with it better.
For you, of going out and telling the story, why is that so important to you, of letting people know what it is that you achieved?
I don't tell them what I've achieved. I don't tell them that.
What's the message you like to get out?
What you want. Mother Earth. I have Earth presentation. That got nothing to do with me. That is Mother Earth, the Earth-based people. You got to get in a global, peaceful community among the species. Get in balance with other creatures that are sharing your lifeboat and a sustainable behavior with the only ship you're ever going to have. That's got nothing to do with me. That has to do with ecology, environment, and evolution. Most of what I talk about got nothing to do with me. I don't talk about what I did, and I don't talk about what the mission was. That's too simplistic. There are people who do, but that's not enough. I am experience-based, so I teach Harvard case studies. I teach scenarios, and so I give people scenarios because, as you know, you're in the business. If you can tell a story, you're way ahead of the game. If you're able to compose and, you know, and put your stuff into some story, all the principles you want to give, if you can do that in a story, you're better off. And so if you tell a story of several scenarios, which I do, then you're way ahead. Because people will learn from scenarios. They learn that better than giving them a lecture. You know, a lecture of principles. No, you want to tell a story. And then you say, what did I learn from this story? I was immersed in some scenario. What did I learn? What was my life's experience there? What are the principles that I can give to other people? But I'm not telling them what I did.
Story Musgrave will be in person at the Proctor's GE Theater on Saturday, the 12th of May at 7:30. You can find out more information about the event by going to proctors.org. Again, it's Saturday, the 12th of May at 7:30. Story Musgrave, a pleasure. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, yeah.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Again, Story Musgrave in person at the Proctor's GE Theater tomorrow, May 12th at 7:30. For more information, go to proctors.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.